Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part one of the recording, which features the opening plenary with Eduardo Gonzalez.
So I say, Waik, Kuksham. I'm saying good morning, and thank you. It's an honor to be here this morning. My name is Dalbert Sampson from the Shuswap Nation of Salmon, British Columbia. I just want to kind of help out everything with a little prayer for everyone. So I say, Kuksham, Kukbi, Kuksham, Kukar, Sinpas, Nurkas, Kuksham, Kukar, Kuksas, Kuksham, Kukar, Mulama, and Solskwa. So I'm thanking the Creator, our grandfathers and our grandmothers, the one that walked ahead of us. And we ask Him to be here with us for the next couple of days to help us out with everything that's going on to make this a success. I also give thanks for all your relatives, all the ones that come around, even the ones that aren't here. We send good blessings for them and ask the Creator that good things come their way. We give thanks for that water that gives us that life that we have. We give thanks of everything that comes from our Earth Mother. Everything that we see, everything that we need kind of helps us out in that way. All the plants, the animals, the fish, the birds, we give thanks for all these things because they give us that life that we have. We also want to give thanks for all those ones that have come on our path that helped us out in our journey since we came this way from the spirit world. We ask the Creator to watch over each one of us as we do our work and give our thanks as we go back to the spirit world. Those four cycles of life. We also ask the Creator to give many blessings to those next generations that are coming behind us, that they get back their language and their identity, their culture, and their feeling good about themselves. And we give thanks for all these residential schools that happened because they taught us many things. They taught us that balance with the English language and the culture today and our own culture, which we want to get back. We give thanks to all these things that happened in that way, and we ask the Creator to give blessings to those ones that are coming behind us to help them in their change so things go in a good way. So we say Kuksham, thank you. All my relations.
Eduardo Gonzalez is a Peruvian expert on transitional justice with extensive experience in human rights advocacy and technical assistance in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Prior to joining the International Center for Transitional Justice in New York, he was a core staff member of the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where he was responsible for public hearings and victims and witnesses protection, and a member of the editorial committee for the commission's final report. Previously, he led advocacy efforts in Global South countries for the worldwide NGO Coalition for the International Criminal Court, a civil society campaign to put into force the Rome Statute of the ICC. A sociologist by training, he holds degrees from the Catholic University in Peru and the New School for Social Research in New York. So let's all please welcome Eduardo Gonzalez.
Bonjour, je voudrais remercier Martin Blanchard pour le Centre de Recherche en Éthique de l'Université de Montréal, Madame Christine Kogel du Centre de Valeurs et d'Éthique de l'Université Carleton et la Commission Vérité et Réconciliation. Merci beaucoup pour le travail. Pour votre aide. Et merci aussi, M. Sampson, pour votre prière pleine d'inspiration. I am very honored to participate in this conference in representation of the International Center for Transitional Justice. The center, as you may know, assists countries pursuing accountability for past mass atrocity or for human rights abuse. We work typically in societies emerging from repressive rule or armed conflict. But we also work in established democracies where historical injustice or systemic abuse remain unresolved. After working in over 40 countries, we represent now the expertise of some of the best practitioners in the field of truth-seeking, reparations, criminal justice, and reconciliation initiatives. The focus of our dialogue today and tomorrow cannot be more important. It is the complex question of national reconciliation after serious violations of human rights. In these discussions, we will join scholars, policymakers, victims, religious leaders, and many others worldwide who have also confronted this question after experiences that are very varied but also very serious. The extermination of the Mayan population in Guatemala during the Cold War, South Africa's apartheid, the destruction of Chechnya, the brutal occupation of East Timor by Indonesia. In these cases, and in many others, in all continents, the horrors of totalitarianism and war have been compounded by an additional outrage, the horror of impunity. In the time I have, I will try to pose you a few questions about the issue of reconciliation in a way that I hope will be useful for the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I will try to bring to the table cases that we in our center follow closely, and I will try to establish the key dilemmas of reconciliation and transitional justice. Then I will interrogate some of the forms in which reconciliation has been understood and the ideas that we in the center advance as a result of our practice and our research. Finally, I will briefly address what I consider are some of the specific challenges of the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It is quite easy to see why, after the atrocities I mentioned before and others, impunity has been more often the rule rather than the exception. The resolution of conflict requires compromise. The international community supports negotiations as the best way to end a conflict or to organize a transition to civilian rule. Now, negotiations generally proceed on the assumptions that actors with blood on their hands will demand immunity from prosecutions as a condition for any progress. Peace or civilian rule very often becomes hostage to negotiators who are still capable of unleashing more violence if they do not receive some form of immunity or protection. Witness, as an example, the fierce resistance to the intervention of the International Criminal Court in northern Uganda or in Sudan. People like Joseph Kony and President al-Bashir have still the power to railroad the international community into resisting justice. The set of expectations that leads negotiators to exchange mutual guarantees of impunity is not just a theoretical game. It is an empirical reality, and it has clearly been shown in studies from experts in transitions to democracy, such as O'Donnell and Schmitter, or experts in peace processes, such as John Elster. Successful peace talks or successful democratic transitions receive also the incentive of universal applause and prestige for the negotiators. Ending violence ensures attention, channels international cooperation, and channels political support. However, it is very difficult to avoid the sensation that there is something missing when you see the picture of two powerful men, formerly in war against each other, shaking hands and exchanging smiles in front of the flashes. The victims are nowhere to be found. The promise of ending violence in the future seems to justify putting the victims aside, asking them to wait in silence. The probably correct moral calculation that any peace is better than no peace becomes too easily a veil of silence that falls over the presumable spoilers, the victims, those civilians who pay the price of conflict, those who put the dead and have little to win in the power-sharing deal of the elites. Now, after the deal is signed, once new elites have taken the place of the old dictators, once former rebels have gotten a slice of power, it is in the best interest of all the political leaders to secure stability. This is not just cynicism. It is, in many cases, legitimately responsible policymaking. Successor governments are entrusted with institution building, with economic recovery, and other important tasks. They are averse to the risk of reigniting conflict by taking still powerful actors in front of a prosecutor. Moreover, in many countries devastated by conflict, there is simply no realistic possibility to deliver justice in a credible way. So ignoring, postponing, assuaging claims of justice seems to many leaders as the right and responsible thing to do. To go back to the examples I mentioned, in Guatemala, not a single high-level official has been punished for the war crimes that left about 200,000 Mayan Indians killed. Retired General Efrain Rios Montt remains a powerful politician, even after he himself presided over the country over the worst years of the genocide. South Africa has not prosecuted the perpetrators who refused to confess their crimes in front of the Truth Commission. Moreover, in South Africa, the Constitutional Court has rebuffed the victims who litigated against the Commission because the Amnesty for Truth deal was included in the Constitution. No Russian soldier or official has ever been prosecuted for war crimes in Chechnya, and it seems very unlikely that this will happen in the near future. The government of East Timor claims that friendship with Indonesia is essential for its future, and therefore the government of East Timor, composed of former rebels who fought against Indonesian occupation, have forcefully pressed the international community not to prosecute Indonesian officials responsible for crimes such as extermination and mass rape against Timorese women and girls. All this poses a very clear moral and ethical dilemma. We celebrate the peace agreements and peaceful transitions to democracy. They save innumerable lives. But this commitment to peace and to democracy seems to pose an insuperable question vis-a-vis the marginalization of the victim's claim of justice. Is it really morally acceptable to maintain that reconciliation between elites, nay, between leaders, is all that is needed? What about the fate of those whose voice is unnecessary for the inter-elite reconciliation, for the inter-elite negotiation? Usually the women, the poor, the marginalized, the indigenous, those oppressed during the conflict and after the conflict. One of Bertolt Brecht's most celebrated poems wonders about the invisibility of the masons who built the Chinese wall, the soldiers who campaigned with Caesar. I think we can also legitimately interrogate power about the fate of millions of Sudanese widows the day that President al-Bashir and John Garang signed their celebrated peace agreement between North and South Sudan. Add to this moral dilemma a political one. Is it really safe to assume that pacts that ignore justice will be sustainable in the long run? Will rule of law emerge in a country where democracy's first act is to delete the crimes of the powerful from the record? Yes, have indicated several scholars and practitioners. Eminent political scientists, such as Bruce Ackerman, have indicated that a post-authoritarian government should invest its limited political capital and its limited window of opportunity in the safe bet of building a constitution for the future, rather than risking turmoil by digging into the past. Others believe that political realities impose, certainly, the need for strategy and compromise, but not the outright abandonment of a justice project. Merely accepting impunity as the cost for the transition keeps business as usual, wastes the opportunity to create a culture of rights and to strengthen rule of law institutions. Civilian rule built on the basis of impunity does not resemble the ideals of democracy and peace for which so many have sacrificed so much. Impunity breeds cynicism among the population and erodes support for democratic rule. Spain is often cited as an example of a successful case of a democratic transition built on the basis of forgetting. However, 30 years after the transition, Spain's political parties continue to fight the struggles of the past, and the voices of the victims claim for belated recognition. Last year, the Spanish government passed a historical memory law that rehabilitates the memory of Republican loyalists and suppresses the remainders of Franco's fascist memorials. Other examples seem to indicate that outright impunity encourages the multiplication of criminal enterprises and hinder democracy. These new criminal enterprises are often led by the same powers that were behind war crimes and torture. More than a decade after the peace agreements, Guatemala faces seemingly unstoppable mafia wars involving members of the security forces and former patrolmen who learned the business of violence in brutal counterinsurgency against the Mayan Indians. Deciding what to do about the past is a critical issue for the sustainability of any political community. Morally, ignoring past atrocity is an imminent act of injustice and a denial of fundamental rights to the victims. Impunity asserts that the convenience of some powerful agents or institutions is justifiable and makes it worth to keep certain other sectors of the population in pain, poverty, or exclusion. Politically, impunity denies a society of any credible opportunity to strengthen rule of law institutions and weaken the de facto powers of criminal sectors in the elites. The concept of national reconciliation reflects those dilemmas. Is it at all possible to imagine reconciliation after a long time of victimization and humiliation to entire sectors of the population? Is it possible to see reconciliation as a matter of national policy, some form of social engineering to facilitate interpersonal forgiveness and healing? Is reconciliation facilitated or not by the reinstatement of the rights denied, truth, justice, reparations? This seems to be the critical question, and it is at the center of both moral and political dilemmas, the question of rights, the rights of victims. If a democracy worth the name requires the full restoration of those rights, how to go about punishment of the perpetrators? Is that a precondition to reconciliation, or should we learn to see reconciliation in a way that does not consider punishment? Radical questions often inspire radical responses, and that is the case of reconciliation. One form of facing the issue of reconciliation has been to refuse any significant engagement with it. Many activists and victims, particularly in my region, in Latin America, have grown tired of the use of the concept of reconciliation as shorthand for impunity. Several military dictatorships in my region and their successors have justified self-amnesties and cover-ups in the name of national reconciliation. These measures have cheapened the concept, and as an understandable result, there is a backlash against it. Many activists in my region of the world consider that reconciliation has become an empty word, more radically, that there will not be a reconciled society, even if reparations, truth, and justice are provided. For some, in this radical assumption, human rights violations are simply proof that the existing society is so doomed by pervasive oppression that nothing short of complete political substitution will do. The organization Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, a well-known organization in Argentina, for example, has rejected systematically reparations, exhumations, and memorialization as compromise policies short of the revolutionary changes that would be the sole appropriate and truly ethical vindication of the disappeared in Argentina. The children of the disappeared have raised defiantly the slogan, "We don't forget, we don't forgive, we don't reconcile." Another radical form of considering the question is, in opposition to the first one, to completely abandon punishment calls. Not as an act of complicity with perpetrators, but as the embrace of a new humanistic ethics vindicating the capacity of repentance and forgiveness. Some declare that retributive justice claims are insufficient for appropriate spiritual healing, or else that they are culturally specific. Departing from an accurate criticism of traditional criminal justice, which is centered on the perpetrator and is often insensitive to the rights of victims, this line of thought takes skepticism of the justice system one step further. It is not enough with reforming the justice system. Criminal justice becomes unnecessary in this view. The practices of conflict resolution, juvenile justice, restorative justice, or the indigenous practices of non-Western cultures, originally established to deal with local conflict or interpersonal conflict, are deemed to provide a full alternative to retribution. Archbishop Desmond Tutu eloquently argued during the tenure of the South African Truth Commission that African traditions made retribution not just unnecessary, but undesirable. Therefore, reconciliation is given a chance, not as a cynical, shallow use, but as a greater aspiration to overcome retributivism and recognize the common humanity of both victim and perpetrator, capable to recreate meaningful social links. I think these two views are extreme and problematic. On the one hand, I'm not convinced that the misleading or shallow use of the concept of reconciliation by supporters of the social status quo should warrant abandoning it completely. It seems to me a strategic mistake to abandon the hegemonic contestation to define what is reconciliation. That is, to abandon the struggle to define what is a fair and just society. On the other hand, it seems to me naive and potentially authoritarian to put on the shoulders of the victims the burden of a social expectation of forgiveness. Moreover, I don't think it is prudent to overcharge institutions of restorative or traditional justice, originally designed to deal with petty crime or local dispute, with the weight of systematic atrocity and the complexity of institutional accountability. In a way, both extreme reactions to the dilemma of reconciliation and justice share the same basic problematic assumption, that the end result of examining the past must be the creation of a radical zero moment of full spiritual and political renewal of society. Miracle takes hold through the radical rejection of the insufficiencies of criminal justice. One view rejects the formalities of institutionalized justice because it's individualistic and because it masks the criminal character of a doomed society. Another view rejects it also, but because the focus on punishment hinders the full expression of human potential. Both positions make impossible demands to the citizens and set extremely ambitious normative ideals. The first position won't accept anything but fully conscientious citizens totally committed to social transformation. The second view expects individuals to reach a level of almost saintly capacity of self-denial through acts of inexpressible goodness. Both attitudes, taken to their logical conclusion, entail severe risks. The first one can lead to the perpetuation of victimization, which becomes a political identity instead of a legal or psychological condition. The second one can weaken rights by encouraging their being waived. To be fair, both extremes are not dominant views. Human rights organizations in Latin America have consistently utilized all the legal mechanisms of constitutional democracy and rule of law. And through silent, stubborn use of the judicial system, they have inflicted several defeats to impunity. On the other side, Archbishop Tutu has regretted the failure of South Africa to provide reparations to victims with the same diligence with which South Africa awarded amnesties to perpetrators. Similarly, in East Timor, work by several institutions showed clearly that the Timorese population, while glad to use traditional justice for minor cases, strongly demanded an international tribunal to try Indonesian war criminals. Engaging reconciliation meaningfully demands understanding that it is a practical challenge and an ethical concern with concrete consequences in the life of a nation. The fact is
that a mass crime puts into question whether a society where that has happened can ever learn to live together. Acts such as the forceful separation of thousands of children from their families to annihilate a culture, facts like the physical decimation of the Mayan Indians, calls into question whether the populations so victimized will ever trust the state in whose borders they live. Engaging reconciliation necessitates looking into that scary question, straight in the eye. Will we ever trust each other again? Will we all, at some point, overcome our mutual perceptions and see each other as citizens? By focusing on this question, we can tackle the question of reconciliation in a different manner. Not as some final, ideal state of things overcoming our current limited status quo, but as a process starting in certain minimal rules of dialogue. Since we don't know how can we live together as equal citizens, we need to have that conversation. Accepting to discuss the nature of the past crimes and their consequences is the first step in the process of reconciliation. Second, a procedural conception of reconciliation, different from a finalist notion, calls for seriously taking into account the conceptions of each participant in the debate and accepting the validity of their experiences and their decisions. Taking reconciliation as a process of discussion on whether, on how can we build mutual trust necessitates renouncing to some transcendent notion of reconciliation that will be imposed on each individual. Nobody can be reconciled by decree. Similarly, nobody can be forbidden to forgive. What we can do, the most we can do, perhaps, is to invite everyone to share views on what is needed to trust each other again and to trust the institutions that we have created. Third, we need to take the burden of reconciliation off the shoulders of the idealized dyad of victim and perpetrator. The question of whether our society can ever be whole, whether we can agree on a conception of citizenship broad enough to encompass us all, specialized enough to recognize and celebrate our difference, that question concerns us all. It is too comfortable to fence reconciliation in a stage where two ideal parties come together for our observation. It is ultimately unrealistic. We cannot be truly citizens if there are persons in our society that remain deprived of their dignity, if there are persons in our society who are protected from the consequences of their crimes. Reconciliation is a truly national process, involving all regions, all groups, all cultures, all citizens. Fourth, ultimately, the decision of a victimized group to trust the other group or the institution that was behind victimization is the result of innumerable individual acts of freedom. The restoration of civic trust is the sum of individual decisions to take a risk. The calculation that things have changed and that I can trust my neighbor of a different ethnicity, that I can actually trust the state to be fair and to acknowledge my experiences and my rights. This is a process and it will take a long time. There will be progress and disappointment. There will be, certainly, unmotivated, generous, miraculous acts of forgiveness. There will be stubborn, brave pursuits of full justice. Both attitudes have a role to fulfill. This million-faced decision to trust each other again cannot, must not, be imposed, because it is, in essence, free. However, it can be nurtured by creating the right conditions for it. Serious, uncompromising truth-seeking and truth-telling are needed to show the victims that there will be no more hiding of the crimes, no more euphemisms, and that they, the victims, can trust an official initiative, such as a truth commission, to take their voices seriously. Reparation policy that goes beyond a transfer of funds and incorporate explicit acknowledgement of wrongdoing, recognizes the dignity of victims and the responsibility of the state. Criminal justice shows that the suffering of victims has not been forgotten and sends the message that everyone, even the most vulnerable, the smallest among the small, the weakest among the weak, the young, the very young, will also be protected, and that it was wrong to victimize them in the first place. Let me share you at this point, share with you one of my own personal experiences from the time when I was a core staff member of the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. During one of our public hearings in the Andean town of Huanta, an indigenous peasant, Mr. Abraham Fernandez, came to tell the commission the story of his indigenous community, Chaca. Mr. Fernandez told us with excruciating detail about each armed attack his community suffered. First, from the terrorist organization Shining Path, intent in destroying indigenous organization and replacing it for their own control. And then from the Peruvian army, for whose members, Chaca people, were probably suspicious because of where they live, because of their ethnicity, because of their language, or for some other inscrutable reason. But then came the worst part of the story. After the community was almost destroyed and exterminated by military attacks from both sides, and after the community rejected with its own forces the Shining Path aggression, when there was peace, Chaca demanded state aid to rebuild in yearly succession their community. And year after year, different state agencies denied or ignored the community's requests to obtain electricity, to build a high school, to build a road, to install latrines. After this litany of victimization, during and after the conflict, Mr. Fernandez looked at the commissioners, paused, and said in a slow and determined voice, "I hope that your truth commission, your investigation, will eventually lead us to a life of equal rights. I hope that 10 years or 15 years from now, we will also be considered children of Peru." It would be naive to claim that reconciliation with the community of Chaca took place because Mr. Fernandez participated in one of the commission's hearings. Even after the execution of reparations policies approved by the Peruvian Congress after the work of the commission, it would be risky to say that Peru has paid its debt of shame with Chaca. It won't be possible to find a zero moment when Peru enjoys perfect democracy, or when we discover an entirely new method of making justice. But the fact that the TRC provided Chaca representatives with a safe forum for meaningful, dignified, direct dialogue with the rest of the nation was a first step in that road. Our commission, after examining hundreds of cases such as Chaca, recommended the criminal prosecution of a number of exemplary massacres and crimes, the implementation of a massive program of reparations, collective and individual, the exhumation of thousands of illegal grave sites, and the profound reform of our security forces and the judiciary. The measure in which we make progress on those areas will facilitate the creation of links of civic trust between the state and indigenous communities. And it will vindicate the miraculous vote of confidence in Peru that the Chaca community made when they decided to come to the TRC. Let me conclude by making a very brief reflection about the challenges faced by the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Our center cannot presume to make recommendations to the stakeholders in the treatment of the legacy of the residential schools. The wisdom of the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, the decisions taken by the Truth Commission, the attitude taken by government and by the churches, respond to challenges they are in the best position to identify. Our role, if that is considered appropriate, is merely to share information and lessons learned in other processes, to mobilize expertise, to serve as a sounding board for creative thinking. Our perspective is based in a human rights commitment. Our commitment to reconciliation is clear, but it is also consistent with our conviction that impunity must not be tolerated. So with that disclaimer, let me modestly propose the following very tentative ideas. First, Canada has formally recognized in the Indian Residential Schools Settlement Agreement, and then in the government apology, that unspeakable abuses took place in the IRS system, and that the system itself was an unacceptable product of cultural superiority beliefs. However, this recognition, at least in those two instruments, has been made in general terms and without clear acknowledgement of the criminal nature of those acts. Now, the outrage of abuses committed against Aboriginal communities and individual children is likely to remain unaddressed while the vast majority of Canadians do not have an opportunity to hear about those abuses in a credible, specific, exhaustive investigation. Without an opportunity for the victims to speak directly to the country and exercise their own capacity of agency, weaving their narratives in the way they see fit, the abuses will still be seen as probable exaggerations. The role of the Truth Commission will be very productive as it removes the veil not just of silence, but also the not less damaging veil of euphemism. Second, while the focus of the current process is the legacy of the residential schools, a true commitment with reconciliation must go beyond the administration of a discrete part of the settlement agreement. As the Royal Commission of Aboriginal Peoples recognized 12 years ago, history shows that victimization of children and families in the residential schools was only part of a wider set of policies, seeking to remove Aboriginal peoples from their homelands, suppress their nations and governments, undermine their culture and their identity. In this respect, the Truth Commission will have a powerful guide in the Supreme Court of Canada jurisprudence, which has addressed the question of reconciliation as directly related to the affirmation and recognition of all Aboriginal rights. Third, while the Canadian Truth Commission marks a first in many respects, it will, as every Truth Commission before it, gather its strength and legitimacy from the victims. The mandate of the Commission, after all, in an ethical sense, is not just an annex to the settlement agreement. It is a mandate from those who are no longer here, for those who were forgotten, for the victims who did not survive. Constant and systematic consultation with survivors and families, with First Nations, Inuit, and Métis will be fundamental. Establishing opportunities for victims to tell their truth without burdensome or inappropriate parameters will make the Commission a reliable partner. Finally, the Commission should be seen as an educational opportunity for all Canadians. Through creative use of volunteerism and communication techniques, the Commission could reach out to the youth in all the country and mobilize resources and initiatives from and to Aboriginal communities. At the end of the TRC process, the Commission should envision a country where very few can say they didn't know, or where very few can deny what happened. These ideas are very basic. Our reflection on reconciliation is very concrete and anchored in the daily, modest experiences of sharing the day-to-day with several colleagues around the world who work in truth commissions, courts, and reparations programs. Our ideas then cannot be very eloquent, and I fear they may sound dry and not inspirational enough for an opening presentation. Let me then quote a letter that our commission, the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission, received from Archbishop Desmond Tutu the day we started our public hearings. He said, "You are about to embark in a difficult journey that will take you and your society to the darkest corners of the human spirit. You will discover things you will prefer not to have discovered. You will hear things you will prefer never to have heard. It is of vital importance that these things are heard, because it is only by telling the truth that we can start to forgive ourselves. We pray for you to learn what we discovered in South Africa, and let me add what we discovered in Peru, that people are fundamentally good and admirable in their magnanimity, generosity, and nobility of spirit." Thank you very much.